All right, good morning again. We are going to begin by the hostess from the Mary and Joseph Retreat Center, Melissa, who's going to say a few words to start us off.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Ooh, nice. You guys are all awake. I'm here to do a welcome. Let me start off by saying welcome, Bigfoot OA, to the Mary and Joseph Retreat Center here in Rancho Palos Verdes. How many here have been to Mary and Joseph? Raise your hand. Well, welcome. And so those who did not raise their hand, welcome to the Mary and Joseph Retreat Center. We were established in 1963 by the Daughters of Mary and Joseph. Here on our campus, there's a building behind this building and a small house behind this way, and we have sisters residing here. This retreat center was established in 1963, and it started as a couples retreat center, but now over the years it's morphed into something else where we welcome all individuals, all different walks of life. And here at the Mary Joseph Retreat Center, it's 8 acres of lush gardens where we provide prayer, serenity, and just a place of reflection. Also downstairs, if you haven't gone that route, there is a bookstore. It's our Heavenly Bound bookstore. We have religious gifts. We have a lot of books and other items. So feel free to browse, and when you're ready to make a purchase, I could go ahead and review books. Also, too, in case you brought your smart devices and you're unable to pick up a signal, we're in the process of revamping our network. So what I was informed yesterday was when you walk down to the office area, the MJRC Guest 2 will show up on your network, and the password is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. How easy is that? And I did post the sign here to my left or to your right. So once you get connected from downstairs, anywhere you walk around the parameters, you will be able to have Wi-Fi. I know we're so, you know, reliant on technology these days. And then for those who will be having lunch with us here in the dining room, it will be at 11:45. Lunch is 45 minutes long. That includes also busting your dishes. So just like at home, we have actually a cart where you scrape off your food and separate your utensils, fork, knife, spoons, cups, etc. And then for those who are brown bagging, please feel free to enjoy our campus, and you can just picnic anywhere. And if you have any questions, I am downstairs. Terry has my phone number. Okay? Thank you.
So, speaking of technology, would you all now please check that your phones are on vibrate? You don't need to turn them off, just if you don't mind, have them on vibrate. So, you've seen the schedule on the back. It'll be pretty close to sticking to it. And I just really personally, because I was the registration chair, I wanted to welcome everybody. I think I know every single person's name and where you live and everything. We are procrastinators, right? We had more people sign up in the last week after the extended deadline was closed. So, excuse me, we have 75 people here today. Bravo. Hence the overflow tables, et cetera. So thank you so much for supporting this. We're really excited about having Harlan and tell us what we should be doing in life. Anyway, as far as the registration, you guys come from all over Southern California, from Santa Barbara to all of Orange County, and raise your hand, the two people from Nevada. Yay! So I'm really pleased that people came from all around. That's just terrific. So if you have any questions, Terry and I are the people to ask. If you have any questions about the book, Big Book, of course, Harlan is your man. So now, before we go any further, I have a need to do a serenity prayer. Would you please join me?
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
I'm going to hand this off to Terry, who will introduce the wonderful Carmen.
Good morning, everyone.
Hi.
Hi. I have a little intro that just so I'm not used to public speaking, so just bear with me. Good morning, I'm Terry, and I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi. Hi.
And the co-chair for this one day. Hello? 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 Okay, great. So let me start again. Good morning. My name is Terry, and I'm a compulsive overeater. Good morning. And the co-chair for this one-day retreat. This main retreat will begin in a moment, but first I would like to introduce our leader for the day, Harlan G. Harlan has been a member of OA since 1979. He walked in the doors of OA in Skokie, Illinois, weighing at 500 pounds. He now resides in Scottsdale, Arizona. Harlan's been absent for 17 years and leads Big Book retreats and workshops throughout the U.S. and Canada. And so now I turn the meeting over to Harlan.
Got it. All right. Can everybody hear me? I'm Harlan. I'm a compulsive overeater.
I'm
so glad to be here today. This is like a home away from home for me in Southern California. And the chipmunks are here. Elvis and Simon, you can't hear me. I don't know.
I think you're okay. These are both on at the same time. I think that's the problem.
Okay, is that the problem? I don't know. Here, I'm going to turn this over to Kathleen. But anyway, you can all hear me. I have a big mouth, and I used to bend at Wrigley Field, so you can't hear me. Really, seriously.
No, we're just
saying
that the mic's
out. Oh, well, Alvin and the Chipmunks are going to be performing soon. I hear them warming up. So, no, I don't know. I'm enjoying this, but...
Are you?
Can we move it forward? Sure, but that shouldn't make a difference, because it feels like I'm... I feel like...
No, it's not on.
Let's do the other one, then. Let's do
okay.
The one that...
Are you sure?
As long as I can walk around and not feel like a caged lion, we'll be fine. Where was I? Oh, yes, I was a Polynesian woman. No, I'm sorry. I came into this world as a compulsive overeater. I have been a compulsive overeater from the moment I was born. Food has had a very unnatural part in my life for as far back as anyone can remember, including me. I have very, very vivid memories of people screaming and yelling at my mother and father in Chicago, which is where I'm from, if you can't tell, even though I live in Scottsdale, Arizona, which is about 20 degrees warmer than it is here, which I would appreciate right at about this moment here. Anyway, where was I? Oh, I remember them screaming at my mother and father about how much I was eating. And then when I got to be about 5 and 6 years old, people started screaming and yelling directly at me about how much I was eating and how fat I was getting. My mother was mentally ill. My mother had 3 very distinct personalities. My mother could be a 3-year-old one minute and suck in some air and become a screaming, raving lunatic, or suck in some more air and become a very together, very, very well-read, very well-informed individual. And you never knew what you were going to get. And I tried as best I could.
This is on mute. Do you want to try it again? Or are you comfortable?
I'm good with this. Let's, if it works, don't fix it, for God's sake. If it works, please. And my dad was 54 years old when I was born. To show you how out of it my mother was, she had no clue she was even pregnant. Not a clue. And the morning that I was born, she called the doctor, and the doctor said, it sounds like a kidney stone, but you better meet me at the hospital. And she went down to the hospital and gave birth to me. And from the very, very beginnings of my life, I became my mother's husband and my father's wife. Not sexually, but I was the conduit of information. They never spoke to each other without pots and pans flying through the air and insults and things you wouldn't say to somebody that you hated. And this is how they communicated. This was their life together. And my mother would come home, and or my mother was home, she'd say, "I hate your father. The only reason I live here is because of you." And my father would come home from work and say, "I hate your mother. The only reason I live here is because of you." And all I really wanted to know is, was Huckleberry Hound going to get away from powerful Pierre? Because I was watching cartoons and I didn't really want to be bothered. And my dad was a sole survivor of murder and mayhem, anti-Semitism in Europe before World War II, that was absolutely unbelievable. There was a family of 40 people, cousins, aunts, uncles, grandparents on both sides. He had nieces and nephews that were from infancy all the way up to 6 years of age that were murdered in an attack on their home, and these memories haunted him his entire life, and he was the sole survivor. So these are the things, these are the groundwork of my life. Is that why I'm a compulsive overeater? Absolutely not. I'm a compulsive overeater because of some things that we're going to be talking about today. And the main object of me coming here is because what we're going to talk about today is we're going to talk about the vast cavern of difference between dieting with group support, which is what you see in so many OA meetings today, and real recovery. We're going to be talking about what I had to do to bridge that cavern between holding on, dieting with group support, and getting into a place where I am at neutral, I'm in neutrality with food. The reason that I haven't eaten a Kit Kat bar today is I don't want to. And we're going to be talking about those things today. I have very, very vivid memories as a child of looking at the world and the world looking at me. And the world would look at me and wonder, why is he eating so much? Look how fat he's getting. And I would look at the world and wonder, why aren't you eating so much? What Lake Michigan reservoir of willpower were you issued at some point in your life that I missed the boat on? Where did you get the ability to take your fork in a restaurant, stick it into a piece of pie, have one bite of that pie and say, "Ew, it's too sweet"? Where do you learn how to have a conversation with somebody with French fries sitting in front of you? What's wrong with you? And they looked at me, and I looked at them, and I thought to myself, one of us is crazy, and I think it's you. And people would say things to me like, "Don't eat so much, you'll feel better." And they would scream at me, and they would yell at me as a child. They were very abusive with me. They say the road to hell is paved with good intentions. I have vivid memories of adults pushing me down. I have vivid memories of adults screaming in my face, pointing their finger in my chest, telling me that unless I get thin, I'll never get a girlfriend. Unless I get thin, I'll never get a good job. Unless I get thin, I'll never look like the other kids. And I found out that not only were they absolutely right, but what I didn't have the ability to tell them as a 6-year-old or a 62-year-old is, I don't have the ability to tell them that I would acquiesce in a second to your demands, that there is nothing more that I would want to be than who you envision for me as a thin kid, and there's nobody I wouldn't kill to get what you want me to have. But Mr. or Miss, or to whom it may concern, I don't know how to get that. And all I learned to do was shut down emotionally and anesthetize myself emotionally. And even as a 6-year-old, even as a 7-year-old, I knew that I could wait them out, that eventually they would get tired of screaming at me. And when they got tired of screaming at me, I knew to go to the one thing, the one place, the one sanctuary that I could go to assuage the tremendous pain that I was in, because they would make me cry, they would embarrass me, and they sent me a very clear signal as a child. And the signal that they sent me was, if you are fat, you are bad. that no matter who you are, no matter what you think, no matter what you do, if you are thin, thin is good. If you are fat, fat is bad. And I wondered at what point do I get exonerated from some obvious series of felonies that I committed prenatally to doom me to a life of being a fat kid. I didn't really understand it. And the one thing that would take care of the shame and the pain and the embarrassment of them screaming at me was the one thing I most didn't want to do, and that was a chocolate chip cookie. Mm-hmm. And in that chocolate chip cookie was all the peace and euphoria that anyone could ask for. And that would have been okay if all I could have eaten was one chocolate chip cookie. But one led to two, two led to 20, 20 led to 70, 70 led to whatever. And the more I ate, the more I wanted, the more I wanted, the more I ate, the more I ate, the more I wanted. And it was just endless. Endless. And puberty brought its own challenges, those feelings that we get as teenagers. And you know, I grew up in the 60s. Don't let anybody kid you. I see some people that know the 60s. You know how they say, well, in the 60s, everybody wanted to march to the tune of their own. Oh, don't believe that. That's a bunch of... Everybody wanted to be the same. And in the 60s, all the clothes were skin tight. All the hair on the girls was straight as an arrow, and all the Jewish girls from my school would go and iron their hair. And I remember them, they'd iron their hair, and we'd look at them like, what the hell? But anyway, remember the Mod Squad, Peggy Lip there with the straight, long hair? Well, that's what, and everything was skin tight Levi's, skin tight jeans. I had to wear clothes that went out of style during the Great Depression, because if it fit me, I had to buy it. And there were many years of my life where I had three, four pairs of pants. All of them were the same color. All of them were the same style. And I had to wear them. And I wanted so much to look like the other kids. And I wanted girls to pass me notes and giggle when I told a joke that wasn't funny, and touch my arm and flip their hair. But that wasn't my... And pass me notes. That wasn't my fate. And I wondered why. I wondered what the heck. And the bottom line is that this illness wrought on its own hurricane onto my life. And I found out at a very early age that this illness is mind over matter. It doesn't mind killing you if you don't matter. And that the only thing greater than this illness is the power of the recovery. And once that power of the recovery became unleashed, then my life started to get a lot better, but it took a long time. And the bottom line is that as a teenager, something else was happening in my life. Not only was I not able to act on these feelings that I had, but my mother and father were dying. My dad was 54 years old when I was born. My mother was mentally and physically ill. And by the time I was a teenager, I was sitting, because I don't have brothers and sisters, aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents. I don't have nieces and nephews. I don't have any of that stuff. I'm sitting in the oncologist's office at age 17, and I'm being told by an oncologist in Chicago that your father has active lung cancer, and the cancer has spread to his esophagus, and it is located in, I'm locating cancer in other areas of his abdomen, and I give him about 7 years, 6.5 to 7 years. My dad died about 7 years to the date of that diagnosis. My mother, from this illness, had her leg amputated, which was actually worse than her death. She first started off with an amputation of a foot, then the leg had to be amputated because of gangrene, and then she eventually and mercifully died. My mother's greatest ambition in life was to become an invalid and die. My father, that's not a punchline, but I'm sorry. My father really also passed on to me a very, very high degree of frustration with being alive. My father felt very strongly and told me every single day of my life that not only are they going to kill the Jews again, but it is just a question of when. It is just a question of when. He was absolutely certain that when Ruby killed Oswald, that this is it. They're going to kill us now for sure. And when things would happen, when certain members of our tribe would get into trouble and it would get in the papers, he would be certain that this is it. Now they're going to kill us for sure. And this is what he passed to me. If you've never seen your father cry, I've seen my father cry thousands of times. My father could be listening to a conversation, and he could be listening to your voice, and all of a sudden, certain things, and he's right back in that house that night in 1914 when the murder and mayhem occurred. He's right back running through the forest, realizing that it was the help at his father's lumber yard that let them in to kill his family. He could be hearing a noise. He could smell a food. He could all of a sudden experience something, and he would burst into tears, and he'd be unable to stand up. We would have to actually console him. And he would hold my face in his hands, and he would kiss me all over my face, and he would say, "The only reason I survived is so you could be born in America. Don't eat so much. Don't eat so much. I want you to be an American. I want you to be an American." And that was what he believed was the only reason that he survived. My life at that time was spinning out of control, and I mean not in a good way. I was 335 pounds as a senior in high school. I was 500 pounds by the time I was in college. My life was absolute hell. I was breaking furniture. I couldn't go to the movies because I couldn't fit in the seat. I couldn't go to a ball game because I couldn't fit in the seat. I'm getting stuck in cars. I can't get in a car. I can't get out of a car. I can hardly walk. My thighs are in different zip codes. I walk like this. I walk like two-gun feet or something like that. But the bottom line is that was only the tip of the iceberg because the swelling in my lower extremity was so profuse that I had pus leaking out of my calves, my cankles, in nickel and dime, penny and dime size ulcers, which were at the back of my legs, which I have bruising, discoloration, and I have varicose veins to this day. For 25 cents at lunch, I'll show you. The bottom line is, I'm living in absolute filth. I'm living in absolute squalor. I'm robbing Peter to rob Paul. I am lying when the truth would have served me better. I am as dysfunctional as a human being can get. From the time I was about 10 years old, this disease emasculated me in the physical and mental sense. I was no longer a man. I was no longer male. I was neutered. I was neither male nor female. I was neither fish nor fowl. I was an eating, weight gaining, lying machine. And the food habit that I had in the 1970s, not my hooker habit, not my cocaine habit, not my heroin habit, was about $100 to $150 a day, every day. I'm writing bad checks to anyone stupid enough to take them. I am in absolute dysfunction. Now, about a couple of days before my mother dies, it's 1976. My mother's dying in the hospital. I walk into her hospital room, and she's lucid. Remember I told you she has three personalities? 3-year-old, screaming, raving, misshapen, a lunatic, and a totally together person. I walk in, and I can feel the atmosphere in the room that she's together. And she says to me, "I loved you. I know that you have nobody now. You have absolutely nobody." She said, "You're going to miss me. You're going to come to the conclusion one day that you love me, and I love you." She says, "Please find a way not to be a slave to food. Please find a way not to eat so much." She said, "You're going to be all alone soon." And she died a few days later. My father, in 1978, was riddled with cancer. My father was a big guy. They used to call him Mr. G. My last name is Grabowski. They used to call him Mr. G, the Russian bear, because for his generation of man, Jewish man, he was 6 feet tall and big. He was brawny. He was big. And he was probably 60 pounds and green at the time that he died. It was horrible. When I had to identify his body at the funeral home, it was definitely his face, but the cancer just ravaged him. and he was a smoker. He smoked one Chesterfield non-filter, and it ravaged him. And in the last night of his life, he said to me, "My Zun," which means my son, "the Fresen Apendu Akunda, Amerl Chazach," which means in English, "Your eating has become a murderous thing in your life. The Fresen Apendu Balachoskis Apendu," which means the Balachoskis were the ones that rounded you up so you could be killed more efficiently and they could steal your stuff. "The Balachoskis was like my eating. It rounded me up so I could be killed more efficiently." And this is what he told me on the last day of my life. He said, "When I looked at you when you were a baby," in Yiddish, but I'll translate for you, "I thought you could be the President of the United States one day. I thought you could be somebody." He said, "You're all alone after I die. Find a way not to eat so much. I don't know what's going to happen to you, my son. I don't know." He died that night. He died about 10 p.m. that night in 1978. Now, you believe whatever you want to believe in. You go ahead and believe in whatever you need to believe in. But I'll tell you what I believe in. I believe my dad had great sway with God. And I believe that he is in heaven because he certainly lived hell on earth. And not more than a few weeks later, on February 2nd, 1979, when I was almost 600 pounds, a couple of friends of mine pushed their way past the filth in the pizza boxes, past the eviction notices, and past the past due notices. And they pushed their way past all this garbage that was in my home, and they informed me that I am going to a meeting of Overeaters Anonymous that night, February 2nd, 1979, just a couple of weeks, just about 8 weeks, 9 weeks or so after Dad died. You believe whatever you want to believe. I believe that my father found some way and my mother found some way to help me and guide me to the help that I needed because they turned over every rock during their life, but they didn't know about Overeaters Anonymous. And I went to my first meeting and I stared at my shoes. And before I went, I ate my way to the meetings. I wasn't a fireball of willingness. I ate my way to the meetings. I prayed for a Russian airstrike during the meetings. And I had to keep going back. And there were people that were in that meeting in 1979 that I embraced as hard as I could when I saw them in Boston last weekend at the World Convention. And that's one of the gifts of this program. That's one of the real gifts of this program. And I came into OA, and I stayed for a few years and lost some weight. But there were things that I wasn't hearing because I don't want to hear. And any time you tell me what to do or tell me that there's work involved, I tune you out almost immediately. And I had a beautiful graduation ceremony. Many of you have had the same ceremony. I graduated in OA a few years later. And I went to the graduation hall and they said, "Welcome to McDonald's. Can I take your order, please?" And I had a beautiful graduation ceremony. And I came back to OA at about 675 pounds. 700 pounds, 750. I came back in 1983 for a while. I came back in 1986. And I heard some things. I heard some things that I never heard before. You snuck some stuff in that book. You snuck some stuff in there, my God. And there were some things in there that I never saw before. Page 58 of this book, it says, "If you want what we have, and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps." And I had a mean sponsor then. I have a nice one now. I had a mean sponsor then. Mean! And he stood in the doorway at the Lincoln Park Alamo Club in Chicago. Anybody here from Chicago? Woo! The real Chicago, not where are you from?
South Bend.
South Bend. You're out.
Lincolnwood, Baltimore.
Out.
Edgebrook, Lincolnwood, Skokie.
Where?
Edgebrook, your Lincolnwood is Skokie.
Edgebrook is the city. You're in.
Yeah,
you're in. You're in play. Okay. Homewood, Baltimore, when I was a kid, was Farms.
Why I was born at Michael
Reese
Hospital.
Okay, you're in. Michael Reese is no longer there, but you're in. You're in. 31st Street and Lakeshore Drive. You're in. Okay. Where was I going? See, I get so sidetracked now. I think it's in the senility.
Me, guy.
And he stood in the doorway like this. He's a big guy, great big guy. And he stood in the doorway and he said, "What are you doing here? I'm here for a meeting. Take it easy." He said, "Why?" I says, I don't know. You tell me. I don't want to get beat up over this." So he says, "What do you want?" I says, "I want to just not eat compulsively." He says, "That's not good enough." And after this exchange, we had it out, and what he explained to me was what we have, in a way, hopefully, are some people who are not eating compulsively. Listen to this part. And they are doing so happily. That they're not swinging from the chandeliers, stark, raving, abstinent. That they're not up there going, I'm gonna do it. My God, you just want to give those people a damn nail mark. Put on their misery, for God's sakes. In AA, they would call that person a dry drunk or dieting with group support. And he would say, "Okay, now are you willing to go to any lengths to get it?" You know what I have to do? And he showed me what I had to do. And then I saw something else. Page 45 of the big book of AA. The thesis line of the big book, where we've been talking about God quite a bit this morning, especially when we get through Bill's story, because we're going to be talking about the history of step 2, and the 2 and 10 are the most underutilized steps of the 12, and 3 and 4 are the most misunderstood. But what he explained to me when we looked at the thesis line of the big book, it says in the middle of page 45, the main object of this book is to help you find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. And that's where I fell off the train. Because I was certain that this God hated me. Because if he liked me, I would have had a girlfriend. If he liked me, I would have been thin. If he liked me, I would have been rich. If he liked me, I would have been the quarterback of the Bears. If he liked me, on and on, I would have had a pony. And I would have had Rob and Laura Petrie for parents instead of Max and Virginia Grabowski. Which is what I wanted. I wanted Rob and Laura. Now, there are some of you too young to remember who Rob and Laura Petrie are. You can Google them. Good God. And then, something else happened. I looked at the foreword to the second edition, page XX in the big book. XX was a size that I used to fantasize about. Because I was a 7X. I used to fantasize, if only I could be like a double X or a triple X or 5Xs, it would be better. I remember being hospitalized one time. I came into the hospital in Skokie Valley. I came into the hospital and I was 513 pounds, and when I walked out, I was 486 pounds. And I thought, man, I'm like Twiggy. This is great. I just showed you how sick my mind is. But anyway, in the foreword to the second edition, it says very clearly, of 100 people who came into AA, 50% got sober at once. And of the remaining 50, 25 got sober. That's 75. And of the remaining 25, they showed improvement. Now, I'm going to get ugly on you. That's 75% recovery. I travel this country doing big book studies. I've done big book studies as far northwest as Anchorage, Wasilla, Alaska. I've done them as far southeast as Boca Raton, Florida. I've done them as far west as here today. I've done them as far northeast as Cape Cod. What's the city near Cape?
Wareham.
Wareham, Massachusetts. Yes, Wareham, Massachusetts. And I've done them all over, and I've done them in Canada, and so on and so forth. We can't talk about 75% recovery in OA. Are you kidding me? We can't talk about 50% recovery in OA. We can't talk about 5% recovery in OA. We can't talk about 2% recovery in OA. We're recovering at the rate of about 1.5% of the people who comes into this door with the most vicious illness God ever put on the face of the earth. This illness is as debilitating and death-defying as anyone out there. This has eclipsed the starvation of the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl. The greatest challenge we have today is the obesity rate going through the ceiling. We have children with type 2 diabetes today as young as 8 and 9 years old. In 1995, in the United States of America, not the United States of Mongolia, not the United States of Uganda, not the United States of whatever, we had a generation of Americans born with a shorter lifespan than their parents. Why? What's the assignable cause? Childhood obesity and type 2 diabetes. I live across the street from a high school. Thank God they can't put you in jail for what you're thinking. But I live across the street from a very large high school in Scottsdale, Arizona. You won't see a lot of drunk kids. You'll see some. You'll see some kids high on drugs in high school. You absolutely will. But you'll see kids walking in that high school that are 250 pounds, 225 pounds, that can barely move. You don't want to know the hell that those kids are going to go through because I've lived it. We're losing meetings. We're losing members. Overeaters Anonymous today has 54,000 members. 10 years ago, we were over 100,000 members. We're losing meetings left and right, and in the process of this meeting today, there will be more offshoot groups of OA springing up than we can count. So what I'm going to charge you with, for me coming here, I'm going to charge you to take what we talk about today back to your meetings. And if you don't have a meeting that's healthy, if you have a meeting that is group therapy, to bring physically your big book and to bring it in your heart and on your tongue and on your lips. I'm going to charge you with that today. Because the renaissance of OA, I believe, is coming from the Vision for You groups. I believe that with all my soul, because they're sticking to this. Now, what is it that they did that was those 75% recovery? They didn't dilute their message. Their message was pure. Their message was simple. Their message was absolutely unified. We will have no unity in OA today until we put recovery back in the meetings. There will be no unity. So that's what I'm going to charge you with today. I'm done preaching. I'm not going to preach to you anymore. But this is where we're at today. This is the situation we're in today. It can start with us. It can start with us today. It doesn't have to start with somebody else someday, somewhere. It can start with us. I'll give you some statistics on me, and then we're going to begin with the doctor's opinion. I've lost a little over 500 pounds since the beginning, since the time. I have 17 years of abstinence, and this is the greatest way of life possible. I have never known a greater way of life. I've never known more joy, more happiness, more deep euphoria than to see the faces of the people here in OA that I see recovering from a vicious illness, from bulimia, from anorexia, from the compulsive overeating, from the hell that all of us have been through. The average membership card in OA today is about $100,000. If I took all the clothes you bought that you never wore, if I took all the memberships to the gym, if I took all the pills and all the times you went to the doctor to have the urine of pregnant women stuck up your butt, if I took all the pay and way dues, and I took all the food plans where they send you the food and all this other stuff, you probably spent $100,000 to walk through the door of Overeaters Anonymous. There is pain in every one of your faces, or you wouldn't be here. There is pain. There is suffering beyond comprehension. And this was the last house on the block. And you came in. Let's not waste it. Let's utilize it to save other people. And in so doing, you save yourself. For thousands of years, going back all the way to Solomon in the Old Testament, going back to King Solomon, people have pondered, wondered about what is addiction, what is gluttony, what is alcoholism. Solomon, in the book of Solomon, believed and wrote that he believed that alcoholism was an illness, but he couldn't prove it, and he had no cure for it. Going all the way back to the 1640s in England, there was a doctor named Dr. Trotter. And Dr. Trotter, he believed that alcoholism was an illness, but he couldn't prove it and he had no cure for it. Around the time of the American Revolution, a man who was to be selected by George Washington as the first Surgeon General of the United States of America, he published a paper in 1790 that he said he believes alcoholism is an illness, but he couldn't prove it and he had no cure for it. And his name was Dr. Benjamin Rush. If you ever come to Chicago, which I recommend you do, you'll see, if you're a tourist, you'll be shepherded down to Rush Street for some of the eateries and some of the dancing and some of the comedy clubs and blues clubs. Very big blues in Chicago. That's the blues capital of the world. But anyway, that's on Rush Street, so named for him. And his great-granddaughter was Barbara Rush, who was in many movies here in Hollywood, and she was an entertainer. She was with Frank Sinatra in Come Blow Your Horn and stuff. That was his granddaughter. Anyway, so for thousands of years, people wondered about what this was and how to cure it. In New York City, around the time of the 1920s, the most preeminent hospital in the world for the treatment of alcoholism and drug addiction was the Towns Hospital in New York, owned by Charles Towns. And the Towns Hospital in New York was the preeminent place to go to dry out. On October the 29th, 1929, Black Tuesday, the start of the Great Depression, which we're going to be talking about in Bill's story, Dr. William Duncan Silkworth, a neurologist, lost everything he had. He had nothing left. And he calls his friend Charles Towns and says, "I need a job." And Charlie Towns put William Silkworth to work at the Towns Hospital in November of 1929 for $35 a week. And between 1929 and 1934, he observed hundreds and hundreds of drunks, of alcoholics, going in and out and in and out of the hospital. Some of these men, now they were not all men, they were not all male, some of them were female, but they were predominantly men, would go out of the hospital and they would never return. They were done. They saw the light and they didn't drink anymore. But, here's the big but, some of these guys would go in deplorable condition and go out and come in, and go out, and come in. Sometimes that day or the day after. And when they would come in, they'd be in worse shape than they were ever, than they had ever been there. And he started to formulate an opinion about what was happening in front of him. And he started to ponder these situations. Let's turn to page XXV in the big book, and let's take a look at William Duncan Stoeckle and his opinion. Now, Bill Wilson asked Stoeckle to write this, and Stoeckle agreed to write it with one condition. The American Medical Association, when the big book was written in 37 and 38 and was published in April of 39, he said, "Don't you put my name in there." He said, "Because if you put my name in there, they're going to run me out of the medical profession." And Bill Wilson said, "Okay, we'll publish your opinion, but we will not put your name in there." But in 1949, Dr. Harry Thibault, Bill's psychiatrist, published a paper, and the American Psychiatric Association, the American Medical Association, accepted alcoholism as an illness, and in the 10th printing of the first edition, which was 1950, Dr. Stoeckle said to Bill Wilson, "You can put my name in there now." And Dr. Stoeckle died in 51. But he remains to this day our great medical benefactor. At Yale University, every semester, they prove the validity of Dr. Stoeckle's famous opinion. They show the brain waves, they show the allergy, they show the twist of the mind. So let's take a look at this opinion, and let's take a look at what we have. And since I'm old, I can't stand for that long. I'm going to sit. So if you can't see me, you don't have to. It doesn't matter. I'm not that much to look at anyway. But here's what we're going to do. We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. A well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. Now, the hospital obviously that we're referring to is the Towns Hospital in New York, and that is to whom it may concern. I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless. Now, for my purposes in my life, when I see this word hopeless, I have to translate that out to be, "Are you out of ideas?" Because if you've got that idea in your mind, and you're me, you're going to go out and try that idea. Until I was completely out of ideas, you couldn't touch me, you couldn't reach me. You know, my friends who are drug addicts, they always have that last drug deal in the back of their mind that they're going to cook up to get them straightened out financially, or you know how that goes. Well, this is the same thing. If you've got that ice cream diet, or that wood chip diet, or that, you know, that black projector diet that you're going to try, there's no way we can reach you. So a question that I have to ask myself a lot is, are you out of ideas yet? And I was 24 years old when I came in here. I was 20, 30 years younger than anybody in that room, and hundreds of pounds fatter. And my sponsor used to say to me, "Are you out of ideas yet, kid? Are you out of ideas yet, kid?" Because I was, as I say, I was 24 years old when I came in, and I'm sitting in there with housewives that are 50 and 60 and 70. I was a kid compared to them, and that's exactly what he called me. So it's very, very important that I be completely out of ideas. I've got to schlep this little thing here over here so I can do this more efficiently. Okay, that's good. I'll teach you the first Yiddish word of the day, amachaya. Amachaya is a pleasure. Amachaya is a pleasure. Okay. To whom it may concern, I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. Oh, wait, sorry about that. In the course of his third treatment, now when we go to Bill's story, we're going to learn that Bill is going to be hospitalized three times at the town's hospital, but we're going to spend a lot of time talking about what happened to Bill between his second hospitalization and his third hospitalization. And we're going to talk about that if I shut up and get back to it. Okay. As a part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. Now, this is a word that will bring upon controversy within OA. Are you recovered? Well, the big book says you can recover. I am a recovered compulsive overeater because I've had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, and the desire to eat extra food is not part of my life anymore. I am not in a position where I'm stark, raving, abstinent. I don't sit and obsess about food. I used to sit in school, and it's 10 to 10 right now, which is like a half hour later than I wish it was. But I'd be watching that clock, and with every passing minute, I wasn't listening to what the teacher was saying. I was listening to, okay, it's 10 minutes to 10, and then we've got 2 hours, and then lunch. So I'd be counting off the minutes until I could bolt out that door, go home, and get some lunch. I personally, bottom of XXV, I personally know scores of cases who were of the type with whom other methods have failed completely. And when the big book wants to tell me something, it doesn't tell it to me once. It tells it to me repeatedly. And it's that other methods had failed completely. If the pay-in ways had worked, if psychology worked, and I'm not knocking psychology, far be it from me, but if that cured your eating disorder, you wouldn't be here. If pills, if amphetamines, I was nine years old. They took me on a massive dose of diet pills. And I remember very distinctly the temples of my head would just be pounding, ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom. And now I'm an eater. I'm not a fighter. I'm getting in fist fights at school. You sleep about 15 minutes a month. You don't eat. But, man, if you've ever been on those pills, when those things wear off, you just drop off the table. It's like a roller coaster. Whoa, boom. And then now I'm eating like Illinois and parts of Wisconsin. It's wild. And then when I was 10 years old, when somebody's talking to you, it's like Charlie Brown's teacher. Wah, 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 wah. You don't know what the hell they're saying. You don't even care. And I get accused of this now by John. I'm saying the same thing like 300 times. And I'm in my head going, stop. You've already said it 300 times. I can't stop myself. I'm just saying the same thing like 300 times. And then when I was 10, they found out some of the stuff about the amphetamines. So they just changed pink pills to blue pills. Same exact thing. I lost weight. But I was nuts. I mean, even more so than I am now. I mean, I was like completely crazy. But the bottom line is that is a very temporary fix. That is a very, very temporary fix. But it looks so alluring. Wait a minute, I'll take these magic pills. What do I have to do? Tell me. Oh, God damn. So the bottom line is, you know, I'm going to do whatever I have to do. A pill, man, I can do that. But does it work? Absolutely not. Not for very long anyway. And it makes you even crazier than you already are, if you're me. Okay, John, where am I? The facts appear to be of extreme. I'm in L.A. somewhere, right?
Yeah.
Okay. What is the name of this town again?
Palos Verdes.
Okay. There was like, I'm driving through L.A. and I see like a horse ranch and a thing. I'm going, what the hell? These facts appear to be of extreme medical importance. Because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group, they may mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. These men may well have a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. Very truly yours, William D. Silkworth, M.D. And Dr. Silkworth left our sight and left our world in 1951. But he will remain forever our great medical benefactor. Now let's see the wisdom that he imparted on us and absolutely everything that we're going to build on. absolutely everything we're going to build on is going to be built on Dr. Silkworth's opinion. Now, I'm going to say this several times today, but the steps are divided into four sections. Admission, submission, restitution, and reconstruction. That's admission. I'm admitting I'm powerless over food. We'll get to that in a minute. Submission, 2 through 7, I'm going to submit to a higher power. And restitution, 8 and 9. And reconstruction, 10, 11, and 12. It went from being cold in here to being like I'm hot. I think maybe I am still on drugs in some way. I'm sure you're like.
All right, maybe.
Or something. I don't know. Okay, admission, submission, restitution, and reconstruction. It's not the first or last time I'm going to say it. The physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe. And there's that word must. We hear a lot of narishkeit. Narishkeit is foolishness in Yiddish. Nar is a fool. Narishkeit is foolishness. And one of the narishkeit things we hear is that there's no musts in OA. I don't know about the OA you go to, but in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the word must appears 72 times. That the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well in our belief. Any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. Now you have to remember, guys and gals, that for thousands of years this was determined to be a weakness of character, lack of willpower, laziness, stupidity, insanity. He is telling us now that there is also a physical component to this illness. We're going to get into that. We're going to delve a little deeper into that in a little bit here. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy. Now, there's that word allergy that threw me off. Not hard to throw off anyway. But that word allergy threw me off. And I asked people. People would say to me, "Hey, don't eat Kit Kat bars." And I'd say, "Why not?" And they'd say, "You're allergic to them." And they'd say, "Screw you, I'm not allergic to them. I've eaten thousands of Kit Kat bars in my life, and I've never sneezed, I've never had watery eyes, I've never been itching all over. What do you mean I'm allergic to Kit Kat bars?" And they'd say, "Shut up and don't eat Kit Kat bars." But the bottom line is that wasn't good enough for me. So I went to a source of information that some of you may remember, I'm guessing some don't. It's called a dictionary. A dictionary. And in this dictionary, I don't know what happened to this fucking thing. What did I do here? All right. Is it working? Oh, all right. This dictionary, I looked up the word allergy, and like a lot of different words, there are several different definitions for this word allergy. And then I found one that applied to me perfectly. It said, any food, beverage, or substance, an allergy is an abnormal, whoa, did somebody just split their pants? allergy. An adverse, abnormal reaction to a food, beverage, or substance. Adverse means it's harmful. Abnormal means most people don't react the way I do. And when I eat a Kit Kat bar, I have a reaction that is different than most people. When I eat a Kit Kat bar, and Ned normal eats a Kit Kat bar, Ned gets all the food, all the candy he wants when he eats that candy bar. As a matter of fact, in most cases, he can't even finish it. He eats a little bit of it. There's 4 sections to a Kit Kat bar, trust me. There's 4 sections to a Kit Kat bar. He will eat 1 or 2, and then he's done. It's over, it's done. He's not eating any more Kit Kat bar for the day. I eat one, and now I want to eat two. And I want to eat three, and I want to eat 12, and I want to eat 80 of them. And the next thing you know, I'm on the toilet, and it's coming out of me in both ends. And in a series of split-second decisions, every one of them must be right, or I've got a nasty-ass cleanup job. Every one of those decisions has to be right, and I'm cursing myself for eating so much. I'm cursing myself, and I'm wishing I was dead. And I begged God for death, and I didn't want to live in this world, and I didn't know how to live in this world. And I was begging God for the onions to take a shard of glass and cut my own throat. And I was begging Him to come and strike me down in the middle of the night so I wouldn't have to live in this hell anymore of the food. I did not want to live in this world. I didn't know how. I was a sideshow. People would yell things at me from cars. People that I didn't even know would slap my stomach and ask me when the baby was due. People that I didn't even know would come up to me in restaurants and they would take the food off my table and give it to the busboy and say, he doesn't need this. And I would go places and I would be a sideshow. Children would laugh at me. Adults would laugh at me. I was a spectacle at 500 and 600 and 700 pounds. And I had to pretend that it didn't bother me. And after all that crying that I did in the bathroom, and I would look as I was washing my hands at my face in the mirror and say, I hate you, I hate you, I wish you were dead. Where would I seek solace from this pain? With the light of the refrigerator shining in my face, looking for something to eat to assuage the pain of eating too much food. Allergy. Adverse, abnormal reaction to a food, a beverage, or a substance. Fits me exactly. Okay. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers, we can say his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. And one of those things that it explains that I had no explanation for was, why am I eating so much in the face of insurmountable reasons to stop? Why would anybody put a marshmallow in their mouth or a Dorito or a Cheeto in their mouth when they've been through what I've been through or you've been through? Yet we do it anyway. We'll find out why in just a minute. Though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as an altruistic plane, we're going to be talking about that altruism pretty soon here. We favor hospitalization for the alcohol who is very jittery or before. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, as he then has a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. What is the big book telling you there? What is Dr. Silkworth telling you there? Put down the food. Or get your head out of the toilet. Put down the food. There's nothing we can do for you. There's nothing that can be done until you have put down the food or got your head out of the toilet. He couldn't be any more clear. And yet you see people, I'm one of them, you see people that come in here all the time and they want to work the steps and have a spiritual awakening and they're still eating. Can't be done. At some point in AA, what they would say to you is, you got to plug the jug. Is anybody familiar with plug the jug? We've got to plug the jug. We've got to plug the M&Ms. We've got to do what we need to do. You are powerless over food, but you're not helpless. You can go to a meeting. You can make calls. If we have to, we'll come to your house and sit with you. You can come to our house and sit with us. We will get you through a day or two so we can begin the journey. It doesn't take a week or a month. It takes about 40, 45, 48 hours, and you're good to go, and we can start at that point. But there's no sense starting when you're all fashmumled with the food. There's nothing that really can be done because that allergy is racing through you, and the craziness is racing through you, and we've got to get that out of your system. So if you're sitting here and you're still doing some eating here and there, or you're doing a little purging here and there, you're doing a little bulimic action here and there, at some point you got to stop. You're powerless, but you're not helpless. You have a whole fellowship. There's 70 some other people in this room. How many of you right now, how many of you are sponsors? How many of you, look around you. Look around you. Look at the people in the room. There's men and women who are in this room that are sponsors. What's disappointing to me, and I won't look at anybody, what's disappointing to me is I've come to the OA birthday, which I recommend, by the way, which is a great convention, and I hope to see you there January 13th, 14th, and 15th. She didn't know I'd get that in there somewhere. I'll get it in again. But I've seen some of you, I don't want to look at any of you, for years, and you're still not raising your hand as a sponsor, and that's disappointing to me. It's disappointing to me, but that's okay. We can go from here. We can go from here and start from here. Okay. I see some of you laughing. No, I wasn't looking at anybody. I wasn't looking at anybody at that point. Okay. But we were. Absolutely. More often than not. All right. More often than not. Okay. The doctor writes, the subject presented in this book seems to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. I say this after many years' experience as medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country treating alcoholic and drug addiction. There was, therefore, a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on the subject, which is covered in such masterly detail in these pages. Now, this next paragraph bears noting. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. What is he telling you there? He's a doctor. He's writing as a scientist. He's writing as a clinician. What he's telling you there is, I know exactly what's wrong with you, and there's not a damn thing I can do for you. I know exactly what your problem is, and we have taken a truckload of dreck, and we have dumped it in the lap of the medical profession and said, cure us, and we'll give you the wealth of Midas. Cure us and we'll make you wealthy beyond your dreams. And they come up with surgeries and they come up with this. What's the largest section in any drugstore? The weight loss pills and the concoctions and all that stuff. What he's telling you here is, I know exactly what is wrong with you and there's not a damn thing I can do for you. You have to have a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Okay, let's continue because we're pushing for time already. Many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book, Bill Wilson, came under our care in this hospital, and while here he acquired some ideas which he put into practical application at once. Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here, and with some misgiving, we consented. The cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men, as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves and still more in the power. Note that power is capitalized. He's talking about God. Not electricity, which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. Now, for the second time, he's going to say something. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures, spiritual awakening, can be of maximum benefit. What's he telling you there? Put down the food, or get your head out of the toilet. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics, chronic just means you do it all the time, Isn't it funny how I've never had a conversation with somebody that where they said to me, you know, it's really hot in Arizona. I don't think I'm going to go to McDonald's and eat French fries today. But when you ask them to go to a meeting, there's 82 reasons why they can't make it. Is that really? Have you ever had this conversation? I don't think I'm going to binge today. It's just, it's too hot. I can't binge today. It's just, it's too cold. It's raining. Oh, I'm sure guys. Anyway, all right, so... All of these phenomena of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. The key word there is never can you use food safely. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. I lost my self-confidence as a 3-year-old. If that's for me, I'm not here. I lost my self-confidence as a 3-year-old. There was one person I knew that I could never count on. There was one person I knew that I would lie to at the drop of a hat. And that person was me. I could depend on you. And I wanted to and did to a very unhealthy degree. I depended upon you because my scared to death, injured, weak, damaged insides did not match up to your seemingly perfectly formed together outsides. And I would turn my life and my will over to other people and they would let me down. And ultimately I would blame God. And ultimately I would want to die. It says here their problems pile up on them. No, I love using this analogy in an OA meeting, but let's envision, if we can, for just a minute, a pie chart. Now, in this pie chart of Fred Normal, he's got a section in here for his family. He's got a section in here for work and career. He's got a section in here for education. He's got a section in here for recreation. He's got a section in here for exercise. He's got all these various normal sections in his pie chart. So he can tackle problems with efficiency. Now here's my pie chart. Let me make it bigger. Here's my pie chart, much bigger than his. And there's one word in there: eating. Eating. Because every waking moment of my life was either spent actively searching out food or actively not eating or hunkering down on unaided willpower dieting with group support. So there was no time for career. There was no time for anything. There was no energy left. This illness is the most exhausting way to live known to man. It's exhausting. I walked around in a daze for decades. So of course my problems piled up on me. I was bereft. There was nothing left inside of me to do anything. Nothing. Let's continue. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. What does that mean? That means that God has a job for you. That you can bring this message where other people are not qualified to bring it. You have a life-giving message of depth because you are the only people in the world that understand and speak the language of the heart. That from a child, you understood that there were people who didn't understand, but you understood. And when you saw that other person that understood the bulimia, that understood the anorexia, or understood the overeating, you connected with them without saying a word. And there are people that are going to be stumbling through the doors in your meetings, and they're broken people. And they have been wiped out by this illness in every sense. They have been vanquished by this illness. This is mind over matter. It doesn't mind killing you, and you don't matter. And you can help them where no one else can. To the world, you're a person. But to that person, you could be the world. You can light them up. But not if you're eating. And we have people, and we have a public relations firm that we're wasting, I mean, we're spending money on. And we have all these various pieces of literature and fairs and things in Phoenix, and I'm sure here too, where we try to get people in the door of Overeaters Anonymous. That's great work. That's fantastic. You've got people sitting in the meetings right next to you that are dying of their untreated addiction, and we're hugging them to death. And they're gaining weight every time you look at them and you say nothing. You don't have to be brutal. You don't have to be an ogre. But you can, with love, say to somebody, I love you. Can I help you? It looks like something's wrong. And if they won't let you help them, then that's fine. But you can try. We're sitting in meetings with people dying of their untreated addiction, and we are hugging them to death. We've got to do a better job. Because of all the ways I want to go out of this world, full of food isn't one of them. Eventually I will die. I will go the way of all things. But damn it, I'm going to live until I die. And I can only live until I die if I'm free of this illness. Because when I'm eating or when I start raving abstinence, that's not living. That's existing. That's not living. I don't want to go out that way. We can do a better job. My charge to you is be that person. Be that shining light. Be that person that helps somebody else through your own good example and for the love and the concern. Honesty without love is sentimentality. I mean, honesty without love is brutality. Don't be brutal. Put some love and put some honesty together and say to that person, I love you, but it looks like you're struggling. Is there anything I can do to help? Don't say it to him in the middle of a freaking room. You know how to have a one-on-one conversation, and if they won't let you help them, fine. But at least you planted a seed. You never know when they'll come back to you and say, thank you. You woke my butt up. You never know. You never know. Okay, let's continue, because we're really pushing for time here. And then Terry's going to get mad at me. John's going to get mad at me. Okay. If any feel that a psychiatrist directing a hospital for alcoholics, we appear somewhat sentimental. Let them stand with us a while in the firing line. See the tragedies, the despairing lives, the little children. Let the solving of these problems become a part of their daily work and even of their sleeping moments. And the most cynical will not wonder that we have accepted and encouraged this movement. We feel after many years of experience that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up among them. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Now, this is a paragraph that I must burn into my consciousness, because this is a paragraph that is one of the axioms, one of the cornerstones of this entire program. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others taking with impunity. Impunity just means they don't get punished for it. These friends that we have, these people, they eat compulsively, or they eat, not compulsively, but they eat, and they don't seem to gain weight, or they don't seem to have the need to purge, or go anorexic, and they're just not getting punished, and we want to test power tools on their skull. Drinks which we see others taking with impunity, after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, spiritual awakening, there's very little hope of his recovery. Now, I want you to put down what you're writing, and I want you to look at me for just a minute. Some of you are sleeping, and that's okay, but if you're not sleeping, look at me for just a minute, because I'm going to lay something on you here, and I want you to remember this. There will be a test later, but I want you to remember it. To the compulsive overeater, food is never the problem. with me? Because some of you are looking at me like I just drew a third ear or something. To the compulsive overeater, food is never the problem. Food is the solution to the problem. What is the problem? The problem is the buildup of everyday normal human emotion. All human beings have emotions. All human beings have sadness, happiness, boredom, anger, jealousy, guilt, shame, remorse. All human beings have these emotions. Every one of us has these emotions. And in a normal human being, 9 out of 10, in a normal human being, these emotions are dissipated readily and easily by going to the gym, making love, drinking a glass of wine, walking the dog, petting the cat, listening to music while you drive with John, which is an adventure in and of itself. All these things will dissipate these emotions in the mind and soul of a normal person. But right up here, on the emotional side of my brain, there is something called the mental twist. And the mental twist is a tool that my brain uses to kill me. I also have the mental blank spot, the built-in forgetter. And the pain of not eating is so intense, so debilitating, so unrelenting, and so disruptive that I cannot take it anymore. And the pain of not eating becomes something that I cannot bear. I cannot bear it another minute. And although I admit that it's injurious, I eat the M&Ms in search of a relief to the unrelenting, searing pain of not eating. The mental twist says, eat Oreo cookies. Now, there's an intelligent side of the brain up here that says, don't you eat Oreo cookies. You've been divorced 6 years. You want to get a girlfriend. You want to be healthy. You want to look good. You want this. Don't eat those Oreo cookies. But the mental twist is part of the emotional side of the brain. And any time the emotional side of the brain is in conflict with the intelligent side of the brain, the emotional side will win in a walk. And I eat the cookies in search of a relief to that pain, thinking that this time it will be different. This time I'm just going to eat one or two. And I eat one Oreo cookie. The pain is gone. But the physical allergy takes over. And the physical allergy demands, sets me up with a biological, actual, physical craving for more of the same. And I eat the entire container of Oreo cookies. And I eat a gallon of ice cream. And I eat a pizza. And on and on and on and on. Now, stay with me here. Don't wake up the person next to you that's sleeping. If they're snoring, you can nudge them. If I can't eat because of the allergy, and I can't keep from eating because of the mental twist, I am powerless over food, and my life is unmanageable. So it begs the question, what if I could find a way to live where my mind does not lock in on that sense of ease and comfort that comes instantly by eating certain foods? What if I could find a way to live where I already feel better? And the process of bringing the necessary power into your life so that your brain doesn't lock in on that sense of ease and comfort that comes instantly by eating a Snickers bar is called recovery.
And that's what this is all about, Charlie Brown.
This is about substituting the effect of the steps for the effect of the cookies. And I've never been to the cardiologist yet and have him say, Mr. Grabowski, I want you to stop doing so many 10 steps. This is getting out of hand here. I'm looking at your blood work, and I think you should sponsor less people. I think you should cut back on the number of meetings that you're going to. I think this is really hurting you, and I think you ought to cut back. I've never had him tell me that. Never. So what we're going to learn today, hopefully, if I ever get moving, and what we're going to talk about today is how to substitute the spiritual awakening through the working of the steps for the effect of the food with none of the devastating, death-defying, horrible, nightmarish side effects. And we're going to be talking about recovery. This paragraph, in the doctor's opinion, is the cornerstone, the foundation. It is the base on which we are going to build everything we have. That the reason we eat is not because we're hungry. That the reason we go to the food is in search of a relief to the normal, everyday human emotions that we feel. And you cannot stop yourself. I hear you thinking, I hear good, I know what you're thinking in the back. Well, if I could just control my emotions, then the food will come along. Good luck. Good luck. Because you can't do a broken brain. You cannot fix a broken brain. So we're going to have to work the steps. Sorry. But, okay. So, you don't have to do it alone. I mean, we'll do it with you, but that's what we're going to have to do. But, sorry about that. Okay. Let's continue. On the other hand, strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, spiritual awakening has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems, he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. And what are those simple rules? They are the steps. There's 12 of them. Men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal, Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me. Faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he sometimes feels his own inadequacy. Although he gives all that is in him, it is often not enough. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. Though the aggregate of recoveries resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable, we physicians must admit we have made little impression upon the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. I do not hold with those who believe alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. So what he's saying to you there is, willpower isn't going to fix it. Willpower isn't going to do it. You're going to have to work the steps. And there's no real way around that. Okay? I've had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all of their interests, so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. There are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. And we see this all the time. I was almost one of those people. I just had given up. I wanted to die. People would say to me all the time, you're going to die if you eat like this. And I'd say, good. Not to them, because it just enraged them more. But to myself, I would say, great, I want to die. Because I don't see a way to live without the food. I saw no life with the food. I saw no life without the food. And if I can't live with the food and I can't live without the food, then what the heck is the point of living? The pain of eating is great. The pain of not eating is great. Where's my life? I mean, what kind of life am I going to have like this? Well, the answer is I'm not going to have one. The classification of alcoholics seems most difficult and in much detail is outside the scope of this book. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We are all familiar with this type. They are always going on the wagon for keeps. They are over-remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision. Now, we're going to learn later today that step three is both a decision and a beginning. It's a beginning and a decision. There is the type of man who is unwilling to admit he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. There is the type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. There is the manic depressive type who is perhaps the least understood by his friends and about whom a whole chapter could be written. Then there are the types entirely normal in every respect except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, friendly people. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving, physical allergy. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been by any treatment with which we are familiar permanently eradicated. So in other words, you can be recovered, but I'm not a cured compulsive overeater. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. There's a huge difference. I'm not cured of this illness. Sets them apart. It has never been by any treatment with which we are familiar permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. That's the third time he's told you, put down the food. That's the third time that he has told you, get your head out of the toilet, get your head out, you know, put down the food. And that's what he's been telling you here. This immediately precipitates us into a seething cauldron of debate. Much has been written pro and con, but among physicians, the general opinion seems to be that most chronic alcoholics are doomed. What is the solution? Perhaps I can best answer this by relating one of my experiences. About 1 year prior to this experience, a man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. He had been partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He had lost everything worthwhile in life and was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him there was no hope. Following the elimination of alcohol, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. In other words, he worked the steps. 1 year later, I'm at the top of page XXIV, or 31 in Roman numerals. 1 year later, he called to see me, and I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features, but there all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time has passed with no return to alcohol. When I need a mental uplift, I often think of another case brought in by a physician prominent in New York. The patient had made his own diagnosis and, deciding his situation hopeless, had hidden in a deserted barn determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party and in desperate condition brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had had a talk with me in which he frankly stated he thought the treatment a waste of effort. Unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, that in the future he would have the willpower to resist the impulse to drink. His alcoholic problem was so complex and his depression so great that we felt his only hope would be through what we then called moral psychology or spiritual awakening, and we doubted if even that would have any effect. Top of XXXII or 32 Roman numerals. However, he did become sold on the ideas contained in this book. He has not had a drink for a great many years. I see him now and then, and he is as fine a specimen of manhood as one could wish to meet. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through, and though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. Dr. William D. Silkworth. Now, it's very important, that we learn that this is step one. Steps one, two, and three are not working steps. They are conclusions of the mind. What is the conclusion of the mind necessary to absorb step one? That I'm powerless over food, and that my life is unmanageable, and that there's nothing I'm going to be able to do that is going to change that. 5 minutes, go pee-pee, we'll be back at 22.